welcome to Talking Beats with Daniel Lalchuk. That's me, and I'm so glad you're here. If you like what we do, I'd love it if you gave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you're so compelled, write a review. That really helps, and maybe tell a friend or family member. They might like the show as much as you do. If you want to get involved in the program, visit our website, talkingbeats.com, and click Support the Show, where you can make either a one-time or a recurring donation. As we look to continue having cliche-free conversations of real substance with a diverse range of the world's most compelling people, your support is so appreciated, especially as we look to expand and increase our offerings. If you have a question, comment, or thought, find us on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, or if you wish to reach out directly, email me at daniel@talkingbeats.com. I'm so glad you're here. Let's get on with today's conversation. On today's program, literature expert David Damrosch. He's chair of comparative literature at Harvard and director of Harvard's Institute for World Literature. He's the editor or author of 25 books, including the Longman Anthology of British Literature and the buried book, The Loss and Rediscovery of the Great Epic of Gilgamesh. He's out with a new book today called Around the World in 80 Books, A Literary Journey, that was inspired by Jules Verne's hero. Setting out to counter travel restrictions during the pandemic, Damrosch takes us on a journey through books around our complex and wonderful planet. But in our time of societal and political pressures, how does one create such a list that satisfies both academia's demands for diversity and public thirst for the classics? Well, David Damrosch is here to tell us.
Well, it seems to me that any writer does live in two different worlds. They live in their society and they live in their own head, which is crowded with all the books they've ever read. So no one ever writes just out of direct experience. It's always filtered through how they've learned to write, what else they've read, what inspired them. And one thing that interests me a lot is how often these inspirations come from far afield. No national writer is reading only their national writers. They are themselves part of a worldwide network very often, and I'm interested in exploring that in this book.
I'm curious, what made you want to write this sort of generalistic book aimed at someone who's not perhaps getting a PhD studying literature of 19th century England?
I'm a preacher's kid, and I'm very evangelical about the literature that I love. I think that everyone should read more widely. And it's a very exciting time in which the field has expanded so much of what we can read. There's so many good translations coming out from around the world and a lot of attention to the wider world. Apart from the sheer pleasure of reading, it seems to me this is a time when we really need to open out our horizons beyond the immediate world we're in, to avoid what Chimamanda Adichie calls the danger of a single story.
How do you avoid that with your students? You teach. You teach classes, you interact with students, you lecture, you talk. What do you hope to get across?
I think that my utopian ambition, for one thing, is that any student who takes a world literature class will unexpectedly realize they need to learn a new language they never thought they needed to know. It was reading Dante and Italo Calvino that made me study Italian. Was reading Aztec poetry in an English translation of a Spanish translation of the Nahuatl original that made me decide I really needed to study Nahuatl. So there's a linguistic level for students, but also just for people generally. I think we're living in a time of shrinking or closing borders, of a kind of rising, often ethno-nationalism in many parts of the world. And I think that literature is a privileged means of access to other worlds, other ways of thinking, other ways of perceiving. And I love to get that across both to students and to general readers as well.
How do you combat ethno-nationalistic trends, to use your term? How do you combat that? You say, here's a story from Hungary. You read it. It's great.
It's a really interesting question because you need some more of a kind of a narrative. You need some kind of framework. You need to draw people in. I think just throwing books at them and saying, oh, you should read this. You should read this. It's like a medicine you should take or something. That's not really going to work.
But that's what this book does, right? Isn't that exactly what this book is?
Well, it took me a long time to figure out how to get beyond saying, oh, here's one good book after another. I think to really work, any kind of course, and all the more any kind of a book for a general audience, needs a sort of a compelling narrative to tell. So here too, this book itself was born out of the world around me and also the world of books. The world around me was they shut down in COVID and not being able to go anyplace. I was about to be going on a bunch of talks around the world, and suddenly I couldn't. But then also I started thinking about all the books written by people who imagined the world beyond where they're able to be. I thought, well, Jules Verne's Around the World in 80 Days was a good model. Jules Verne himself never went around the world. He never left Europe, as far as I know, at all. And when he was writing that book, he was just in Paris for 8 weeks or so. And yet, through his imagination and through the other things he's read, he could experience the wider world. So then I thought, all right, I could make this a kind of adventure story itself, a travel through these books, and sort of draw my readers in through looking at 16 different worldly locales and the great works they've inspired, and then creating kind of networks or interweavings of the text within each chapter and across chapters to actually make an experience of experiencing the world through literature.
Indeed, you were going to do some traveling yourself, or you did do some traveling yourself. Why do you think it wasn't good enough for you to get a copy of the book, read it, like it, whether it's from India or China or Australia or down the road in New York City? Why isn't that sufficient?
That's a very interesting question. I do think that this interaction of literature in the world is very important to me, and I think to many readers. I think that we need to not only think about the world, but actually be out in the world. It really matters a lot to not just stay within our own four walls when we're able to travel beyond them. And to me, it's been really opening out the world. To work on world literature has meant that I'm going to a lot of places and talking to people in different parts of the world. And often, in their case, they don't know very much of the world around outside their own country and perhaps major Western European literatures. So it's also a matter of getting audiences in China to think about literature from Africa and India and to sort of open out the world around the world.
It's interesting what you say about place. We had a couple of months back Andre Osiman on here, and he was talking about the Alexandria in which he grew up has nothing to do with the Alexandria of today, and it does very little for him to go there, to have anything to do with this place that's so radically changed. Obviously, nothing is fixed. Nothing is cemented. It's always malleable, and a place could have no relation to what we read on the page, right?
Well, that's very interesting. So Andre is a very interesting case of someone whose world disappeared, and his famous book is really a nostalgic look back at a vanished world. And that's something that literature can do as well. But to me, then, entering into that world can also be a way of thinking about deeper continuities that exist beneath what seems to have changed so radically. In the case of Egypt, one of the authors I talk about is Naguib Mahfouz, and he wrote a series of historical novels about the times of the Egyptian pharaohs, very much oriented, however, as well to the present. And I think that Mahfouz would say that in Egypt, everything has changed and nothing has changed at all.
Talk about how different this book would be had you written it 5, 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. It would have been different even a year earlier. Even as I was writing it in the blog form that it began in the summer of 2020, the Black Lives Matter movement was happening, and that caused books to come in that probably weren't originally in the plan. Both Chimamanda Adichie and also James Baldwin were not originally among my 80 books. I had already had Derek Walcott, a bunch of African writers, the Afro-Brazilian Machado de Assis. But then with the Black Lives Movement, all right, I thought I need to do more, and I want to connect more to what's going on in my own country as well. So those works came in. Equally, a big change from my own student days, of course, that's in the pre-modern era, the 1970s, there were very few women on syllabi in universities outside very specialized women's studies courses. But world literature, for example, was almost entirely a male preserve. The Norton Anthology of World Masterpieces had a grand total of 0 pages in the first edition by any woman in the history of literature. They finally added 2 pages by Sappho in a later edition. This is a huge change since then. Now every one of my chapters has women writers. that simply would not have been seen outside of very specialized courses until about 20 or 30 years ago.
But is that because you feel you had to fit into certain sociological, social developments, or because you felt that the quality of the writing was so high that it must be included in this book?
The great thing about working on world literature is that there's so many things to choose from. And I will never write about or teach a work that I'm not in love with. I don't think it's just profoundly moving. Now, there are many ways a book can be great. The old canon of great books were all great books, but there are a lot of books that didn't fit a certain definition of greatness that perhaps we look at more broadly. So every single work I'm looking at among these 80 is a compelling work, now on different scales. So the murder mysteries of Donna Leon or the Israeli crime fiction writer Dror Mishani are amazingly fascinating works of a different kind than Dante, let's say, or James Joyce. But some of these works that were simply left out, let's say The Tale of Genja by Murasaki Shikibu, arguably one of the two or three greatest narratives ever written by a woman anywhere, now that's written 1,000 years ago in Japan. I just fell in love with that book 30 years ago by finding it in translation. I have taught it regularly. So there's a question. That's a case in which I say that absolutely she stands next to Virginia Woolf, James Joyce, indeed Dante. Whereas someone like Joko Alaharti, who just won the Man Booker Prize, the first Omani and the first Arab woman ever to win that prize, is a remarkable writer. She's a contemporary writer. She speaks to us today. It's a different kind of greatness and interest than Dante or Murasaki speaking to us from 800 or 1,000 years ago.
And people who listen to this program will know that we've spent an entire episode on The Tale of Genji with the great Dennis Washburn, who has the the translation.
Yes.
And in fact, a book was just published in a whole addendum of notes, which is, I think, even longer than The Tale of Genji itself, which they both weigh about 50 pounds. So wow. You really need to do some sort of bicep curls before lifting that thing up. And indeed, you know, you mentioned something about speaking to us today, but speaking to us today, having the ability to communicate with a modern audience, it's not a prerequisite to be written anytime recently, right?
That's right. Now, it does mean that only some of the great books of the past have a kind of currency today. Not every really great book translates either linguistically or across time or across culture. So there are major works that are beloved in their culture that may never be well known outside. But then something like Tale of Genji, which has had multiple translations into English, I think four complete translations in the last century, including Washburn's excellent one. You know, there's so much there. There's sort of a psychological insight. There's so much nuanced sense of women's asserting their strength in the way they can in a very patriarchal landscape. It's such a beautiful aestheticism. There's such an ironic sense of life. There's so many ways in which it really speaks to us today. I'm particularly interested in ancient Near Eastern literature. I've worked on that a good deal. And so you have the earliest works that I have in my book are from a collection of Egyptian love poetry from the Middle and New Kingdom, Egypt, 3,000 or 3,500 years ago. And these are poems that just jump out at us today. I sail downstream with the current and I say to Ptah, give me my girl tonight.
It's wonderful. Give an example of a place we should maybe start. So the book is here. It's divided into these sections. I'm looking at it now. It's sections of geography. For example, there's a chapter on London. There's a chapter on Paris. There is Krakow after Auschwitz. So obviously that is fairly obvious what that's going to be about. Venice, Florence, the Congo, Nigeria, you go all over the Middle East, Shanghai, Beijing, Calcutta, etc. So first I'd like to know how you divvied up the world into 16 parts. And obviously some things are obvious. You're going to have a chapter about New York and London, okay. But beyond that, then sort of let's just look at New York. An example, J.R.R. Tolkien, Saul Bellow, who I knew very well, by the way, when I was a child, and I played for him some cello at his apartment, at his house in Brookline, by the way, some Haydn I played for him. James Baldwin, Saul Steinberg, and Madeleine Langler. So talk about the division of the world and the 16 parts, and then talk about choosing, because choosing is very hard.
Well, it was hard for me because there's so many places I was interested in talking about, and almost without exception, these are places that I've been, that I've been struck by the interaction of the way these works of literature help shape our sense of those places. So that's indeed, whether it's Murasaki's Kyoto, even as much as Kyoto is a very modern city, it's also filled with temples and structures and echoes going back to this medieval Heian period. Or in the case of Rio de Janeiro, you can have a selfie taken by next to the life-size statue of Calais Lispector looking over Copacabana Beach. And in Istanbul, you can go visit the Museum of Innocence that Orhan Pamuk constructed at the same time as he's writing his novel. In Cairo, there's now a Mahfouz Museum. So all around, these authors have an ongoing life. And at the same time, then the choice was difficult for me, partly because I didn't want to write an 800-page book. I didn't want to have to people lift their biceps, work on their biceps before they could lift my book. So it had to be, you know, reasonable in length. And also because I was doing it originally as a blog form, there's a discipline. Of course, it was set by the idea of the voyage in 80 days. And I actually did this originally in the blog form in 80 days, 5 days a week for 16 weeks. So I only had 1,600 words per book, and I only had 5 books per place, and I only had 16 places. Or it would have, you know, killed me to do more. And I thought 16 was good. I originally had 20, and I thought I was just getting too scattered, which meant I had to leave out Lisbon, which I'd have loved to have. Iceland, I worked some on Icelandic materials. Rome would have been very logical. Athens, hard to live without. And there's so many other places. But I wanted to have a mix of the familiar and the unfamiliar for any given reader. And I did think starting in London made a lot of sense, London and Paris, the first two chapters. Partly because Jules Verne, of course, starts and ends in London, so I wanted to follow that. And he was, of course, writing it in Paris. So it has a sort of base in the literary source that I'm playing off against. But also, I think, for the reader to start with Virginia Woolf and Sherlock Holmes and Charles Dickens, extremely familiar, P.G. Woodhouse, and then only somewhat less known, Arnold Bennett, very interesting writer with whom Woolf was in a kind of rivalrous relationship. So you start close to home for readers, for Anglophone readers who are likely to know most, if not all, of those writers rather well, and then show them how differently they look when you start to think of them as world writers. So the most local novel possible, Mrs. Dalloway, is filled with these echoes of Greek tragedy, of Chekhov, of the Indian Empire of Britain, of World War I, and the European conflict. So see the worldliness of the most local novel, and then go from there out into the world.
A very well-known book, of course, that introduces a wide readership to books is The Western Canon by Harold Bloom. And he says aesthetic value is sometimes regarded as a suggestion of Immanuel Kant rather than an actuality. But that has not been my experience during a lifetime of reading. Things have, however, fallen apart. The center has not held, and mere anarchy is in the process of being unleashed upon what used to be called, quote, the learned world. How do you respond to that?
Well, I'm very much a both and kind of guy. Harold was a good friend, and I admire his work. And, you know, I know what he's talking about. I agree with him completely that aesthetic value is fundamental to our experience of literature, and I would say of art and of music equally. At the same time, I would not go along with his sort of grumpy old man persona of, oh, it's not like it was when I was a kid. People are reading The School of Resentment, what he used to call, which is absurd. The opening out of the canon beyond the 26 authors in his Western canon is a wonderful thing. Now, it's only a wonderful thing from my point of view if you open out to works of compelling aesthetic quality. And there I would completely agree with him. But it's a much wider field. And even the Western canon, ends with 2,000 books at the end that you might want to read, which includes works by a lot of women, African-American writers, people who simply would not have been ever on a syllabus in the Yale English department when he was a student or a junior professor there.
So he moved things along, obviously, but I guess took a narrower view than you seem to hear. I mean, you cover sort of the globe.
Well, yes, it's a very different perspective. And for me, it partly has to do with growing up as a son of missionaries, Anglican missionaries. My parents had met in the Philippines. So I always heard about this other part of the world. And then also on my father's side, we were a Jewish extraction. And so there's a kind of a biblical interest and a multicultural sense of Europe itself. And then when I was a teenager, my father had a parish in Manhattan right a few blocks from the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where I just fell in love with Egyptian art there. So for all these reasons, somehow the world just opened out to me very early on. Now Bloom has advantages of specializing so much in British Romantic poetry. I remember a colleague of his once said he never heard a poem in English mentioned that Bloom could not recite from memory. That's a wonderful kind of skill, photographic memory. But it's a very honed in on one particular time and place. I just have a different perspective on the world today.
How important is it to memorize, do you think? I remember learning with a partner of mine, I think in seventh grade, we each memorized half of The Raven, and we each did half in front of the class. And that's quite a bit to memorize. I, of course, have been memorizing music my entire life. When I studied Dante with Robert Hollander, I indeed was encouraged, more than encouraged, to memorize lots. And he claimed that there was a farmer somewhere in the outskirts of Florence who knew all 14,000-something lines of the entire Divine Comedy. How important is it to memorize? You talk with your students about memorizing, getting the words into their bodies.
I'm sorry that this is a skill that has largely been lost. It's not an emphasis that most people have in the U.S. I was very struck visiting Shiraz some years ago. My host took my wife and me to the tomb of Hafez, a great medieval poet, and his daughter-in-law came along. She was a young physician. She started reciting his poetry from memory, and I think it's a wonderful thing to have that ability. And I think we should do more with that. And in particular, the music, and you're speaking of memorizing music, the musicality of not just poetry, but prose itself is absolutely fundamental. So what I do try to get my students and my readers to do is to try to hear these texts. I just recorded the audiobook for the Around the World in 80 Books, and I really want to do it myself because not only because there's a lot of foreign words and names and things like that, but also I really wanted to convey, if I could, the musical power of the quotations that I give.
And you do seem to have a good ear for languages. I don't think I'm imagining that, but you do seem to at least make an attempt to pronounce different names differently.
Absolutely. Well, I've studied to some degree of incompetence a dozen languages, but I do think it's because I'm from a musical family, actually. That the ear has always been very important.
I was going to ask, because when I saw your name, the first thing I thought about was the conductor, Walter Damrosch. Is there any relation?
Right. Yeah, pretty much any Damrosch you meet is a relative, because it's a very unusual name. It was actually a back formation from German into Hebrew, probably around 1800. So Damrosch is like a translation of something that would really mean like Blutkopf or some name like that. And so my great-great-grandfather, Leopold Damrosch, became a musician. He got a medical degree, which his parents wanted, but he really was a violinist and wanted to be a conductor. And so he started conducting. He was Franz Liszt's first violinist. Liszt was actually the godfather for my great-grandfather, Frank Damrosch, after whom he was named originally Franz. And then Leopold came to the U.S. to conduct a German choral group and then get involved with the Metropolitan Opera. And his two sons, Frank, my great-grandfather, Walter, his brother, and their sister were all concert artists and conductors. And then the musical talent has not survived so intensely since then, but I did meet my wife in college in a production of Gilbert and Sullivan's Trial by Jury, where we're both in the chorus. So music remains very important in my life.
Yeah, he was a fine conductor, Walter Damrosch.
Yes.
He was a very, very good conductor.
Well, he was also very interested in popularizing music. So he conducted on the radio, much like Leonard Bernstein later. Really, really conducting for people, getting them to love Schubert and Wagner, who was a family friend. And my great-grandfather, Frank, both founded Juilliard, which, you know, premier conservatory for professionals, but also was very involved with something called the People's Choral Union, very interested in getting people to just sing in large groups. They would take over Carnegie Hall once a year to do a huge concert for themselves using every seat. So I think that's something that I feel very connected to, that this mixture of the professional and the general outreach.
Which is what you tried to do in the book about which we've been speaking. Okay, you love music. You're related to a fine musician, Walter Damrosch, who was a very good conductor, by the way, died in 1950. He was born in 1862. I didn't know, by the way, he did the premiere of the third piano concerto of Rachmaninoff with Rachmaninoff as the soloist. I learned that. Wonderful. What is music to you?
And to say, he also commissioned a late work from George Gershwin, so that Walter himself was interested in different kinds of music, even though the primary was, of course, the classical background. And music has always mattered a lot to me. I was obsessed with Beethoven string quartets when I was a teenager. We'd listen to them all the time on old reel-to-reel tapes. We remember those.
But someone listening with... I only know the term.
That dates me, yes.
I know the term. I know.
Big reel-to-reel tape, not cassettes, big reel-to-reel tapes.
I know what they look like. I'd be able to pull it out of a lineup.
That's right, that's right.
What recording of the Beethoven Quartet?
It was then the Juilliard String Quartet was the one that I had at that time. Actually, I did a couple of different ones, but they and one or two others. I would say that music has mattered and still matters a lot to me. I listen all the time, mostly classical music, but also a certain amount of blues and jazz. And I'm obsessed with Astor Piazzolla, to speak of Latin American music. And he's, of course, a very interesting crossover figure who does also classical compositions as well. The musicality of poetry has been foremost. In fact, it goes back, in the whole history of poetry is connected intimately to music. The ancient Egyptian poems I mentioned were preserved in tombs in collections with titles such as the Songs of Excellent Enjoyment. And in the book I include a scene from a tomb wall showing a troupe of very scantily clad women musicians who were singing one of their songs. The Aztecs spoke of poetry in a double phrase of Inquicatl in Xochitl, which is bird song and flowers. That's what poetry was. Where you think of the greatest medieval minnesänger, Walter von der Vogelweide, perfect name, Walter from the Bird's Meadow. And his most famous poem about a nightingale is looking down and singing discreetly about a pair of lovers on the meadow beneath him. Even prose, though, I emphasize this in the book. In Stockholm in 1988, when Naguib Mahfouz accepted the Nobel Prize for Literature, he said that the Arabic language is the real winner of the prize. He says, "It's meant that its melodies should float for the first time into your oasis of culture and civilization." I think also another of my authors is Rabindranath Tagore, and I show I have a picture of him, a portrait done in 1916 by my great aunt Helen, who is an artist. In an interview on that trip when he was in New York, he says that the proper function of the poet is neither to direct nor to interpret his fellows, but to give expression to truth, which has come to his life in fullness of music. And now I have a novel by Tagore. He was also a great poet, and he wrote 2,000 songs, many in service of the Indian independence movement, including one which is now the national anthem of India.
Very interesting. Indeed, I think a long time ago, medieval age, there was a lot of interaction between poetry and music, and all of these sort of troubadour musicians. We had the great Michael Tilson Thomas on, and in fact, he said he was on a troubadour kick, and all of this great music for one voice, for sort of maybe a little guitar accompaniment or something like that, and the poetry all going along together. It was just how it was, naturally.
Absolutely. And I think that the intimate connection of poetry and music, as I say, goes back as far as we even know. And I think it was only really in the 18th or 19th century that people even started reading silently as the normal way to consume literature. Normally, you would speak it as you're reading it. And even, say, Charles Dickens could be read, of course, as big novels silently, but often they were read in little family circle in the evening. They didn't have Netflix and they would read Dickens chapter by chapter. And he wrote to be read aloud, and he performed his own text very often. And I think that kind of vocality and musicality of really beautiful prose is as important as the musicality of lyrical verse.
And we talked about that a lot on here. We've had on James Shapiro. We've had on Stephen Greenblatt. Actually, a couple nights ago, a friend of mine said he was off to a group reading of a Shakespeare play. I said, which one? He said, they don't tell us before. You have to just show up. And go. Uh-huh. I thought that was just a wonderful thing, and I love hearing it out loud. And when I was I never forget seeing the wonderful production of King Lear at the Old Vic. My dad brought me when I was a freshman in high school over to London. Of course, going to the Old Vic was a must for us, and the power of the. But of course, then you're also not just talking spoken word; you're talking sets and lights and costumes, and great actors. What do we get from just reading it? Take all that away. You know, we're no longer in the world of opera. We don't have lights and effects and everything. We're sitting down. We're listening to a symphony. We're sitting down. We're looking at a page. What do we do? How do we do it?
Yeah, it's a very interesting translation that happens from the group to the individual. And I think I've often thought that the Homeric poets who created the Iliad and the Odyssey, and who were originally illiterate, though we have them thanks to the fact that someone wrote down these great versions, but they must have wondered, well, what's the point of this strange new graphesis or writing? You don't have performance in the Odyssey. Not only do you have a bard represented as singing, but there's actually a floor show. These boys come out and dance while he's singing his epic episode. So that is that, you know, the sort of the Broadway musical has nothing on the Homeric court scenes in Phaeacia. So that was very, very strong there. Now, when we read to ourselves silently or better aloud with an ear, I think it clearly works just as well, or it wouldn't work. And in fact, I think it takes a different tonality to use a musical term. What it does is it liberates the imagination in a whole different way. You can sort of dream, you can muse, you're not, you can start, you can stop, you can think, you can envision it yourself. You can populate the magic mountain with whatever kind of trees you like to have on that mountain. So unlike, say, with a movie, which is compelling because it will have the music, it will have the action, or a stage theater, that is going to be given to you by this prop manager, the director, the movie maker, the actors and actresses. Whereas now we get to create it for ourselves. And I think that's one of the most pleasurable and illuminating facts of literature, that we create a whole world inside our head.
That seems to be sort of the crux of the whole thing, right? It points us to places we didn't know existed before we went there.
And indeed, some of those places may never have existed. It can be Utopia, it can be Tolkien's Middle Earth. And yet from those places, you get a unique vantage point back on your world.
And not to mention the sharpening of the mind that reading mm-hmm. does. But it's not popular now, or is it? Is reading, where are we? Do people read as deeply, as much, as well as they should?
I'm not so much inclined to make people feel guilty about, oh, you need a healthier diet of difficult works, something like that. I think there is more consuming of narrative than ever, and of song than ever, particularly if we look outside the narrow bounds of at the Philharmonic. That Bob Dylan won the Nobel Prize in Literature recently is an interesting indication of this. I was just reading this summer Keith Richards' memoir of life and Patti Smith's Just Kids. And I'm reading now a big biography of Fernando Pessoa, who is another writer I would have loved to have been. So I see more a continuum here between the very, very widespread interest, both in popular song and in any kind of narrative, whether it's the Netflix series of the Queen's Gambit, you know, which is a fantastic series.
That was absolutely terrific. Absolutely terrific. Yeah. I absolutely couldn't stop watching that. And that doesn't happen to me usually. So watch an episode, okay, time to go to bed or something. It was really just wonderful. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one reason I'm interested also in detective fiction, which is the most widespread form of world literature that there is. And I think there's a certain tendency sometimes in academia to kind of look down on, oh, popular literature. That's also why I'm interested in Tolkien. He sold 150 million copies, outdoing all but the very most popular video games, and indeed inspiring many video games, right? And you couldn't have the modern video game without Gandalf and wizards and that whole sort of world, or at least a whole strand of the modern video games. I think that there's a real interaction between these great works of literature. And if you're reading Tolkien, you know, you've got 1,100 pages to read. And if you're like me, you read it several times as a kid, or the Harry Potter series, again, now, equally so. So now then it's a question that not everyone is going to sit down and read Middlemarch probably today. And I haven't reread it in a long time. And it's very, very hard now to teach very many 800-page books in a college course, even an Ivy League college course. The students are too busy on their social media and everything else they've got going on.
Isn't it up to you to carry on the tradition? Isn't it up to you to say, I don't know, maybe the answer is to say you need more hard books in your life. You need to be reading and to take a harder edge approach. Sometimes with music, I think that's the better solution. You need more Beethoven, Mozart, Brahms, not less.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I absolutely believe that. But again, it's a question of how you approach it. And I will start from both where the students are, and I'll start with the pleasure principle. You need to read these exciting books, and I will give them. So I can't now assign them the entire Divine Comedy, although in our world literature anthology, we have the whole Inferno, but it's only the first third. If you really want the Divine Comedy, you want all three canticles. Now, at the same time, how are you going to get them to read the whole Divine Comedy? You're going to get them thrilled about some part of it. And I very much hope and count on the fact that if I teach a course well, it will inspire students unpredictably. They're not going to go home and read the entirety of every work that summer. But if they'll read the one that catches them the most deeply and they really get deeply into it, then I think I've done my job. So I teach Proust all the time. I teach Murasaki all the time. I can never teach the whole thing. The 3,000 pages of the Recherche du Temps Perdu, I wouldn't be able to fit it in. But I will teach the first volume, or I'll teach the Swan in Love section of the first volume, and there's so much there. So I also think that the reading intensely is a very important skill that we have to teach in school. But I also think increasingly that less is more. That is, if you read well one episode in Proust and really come to understand it, it can change your life, and it could inspire you to then feel you really have to read the whole thing. The fact that there are now these multiple translations, the new translations of the Tale of Proust, Tale of Genji, there is actually a market for these big books. Now, not every book will survive that transition, just like not every classical work survived the transition to the interest in the modern literatures. Homer is doing very well. Statius, not so well. But that always happens in the history of art.
What do you do in the culture that is, I think, increasingly shying away from tough issues, from controversy, from disturbing imagery, disturbing texts, a culture that embraces trigger warnings, a culture that embraces burnishing and smoothing the rough edges? What do you do? Not everything in literature is easy and pretty.
Absolutely. And I think it's a matter of reading with sensitivity works that are not going to simply fit our predispositions, and that's a lot of the value of reading world literature and reading world literature from earlier periods, so that Shakespeare is a good example, right? He has a whole different kind of world than we do. Yeah, he, among other things, believes in the importance of strong monarchs. So at a very basic political level, he's got a different view. He has a different view of the role of women on the stage. You couldn't even have a woman on the stage. You had to have boys dressed up as women. It's a different world altogether. Or if you look at Homer, you're not going to learn a lot about peasant life and mores from Homeric epics. Or in the case of, say, Saul Bellow, I take Henderson the Rain King, which is this imaginary trip to Africa where he had never been. And he has representations of Africans there that are problematic. And I'm going to say that is problematic. He does place on some of these stereotypes. At the same time, that's not what I'm reading him for. I'm not making a mistake of thinking that's what I'm going to learn about. I read him because he knows he's inventing an Africa that will be a satiric take on America, much as Voltaire was doing and going to and pretending to send Candide to South America, where Voltaire had never been. So if we read it with sensitivity to what they're doing and note what there is that we have to say, this is not something we can accept. A work that is dominated by those things will never be something we're going to really want to read or work on. But a great writer like Saul Bellow will often transcend his own prejudices. And I think that's an interesting thing to follow.
Do you feel pressured by colleagues or students to delete certain things that you would have taught or you'd like to teach or include other things that you're not particularly inclined?
Well, my colleague Homi Bhabha has remarked to me he's not quite sure how he can teach Huckleberry Finn anymore. Can he read passages that are just there and that's part of the world that Mark Twain is writing in? So it's a question, but I tend to push against it. I think trigger warnings are fine. I say, look, this is going to have things that are going to be offensive to you. Be aware of this. And when I teach some films that may have very explicit sexual scenes, I say to the student, right, you can fast forward through that if you don't want to see this, but this is integral to the work and it's there and you can deal with it one way or another. And of course, particularly for anyone who is any kind of a feminist, most literature written by men and a lot of literature written by women before the last 50 years is going to have different representations of sexuality, of gender relations than we would like to see today. At the same time, I think it's really important to see where we come from and to see what they're doing often very much to complicate those norms of the time.
And then one has to wonder if that even matters. What does it matter to me that Shakespeare has certain representations of women? If I'm reading Shakespeare or going to a Shakespeare play for the enjoyment of the genius of the creation and the development of the characters of the drama, of the inner thoughts. Who knows what Shakespeare really believed about Jews, but I'm there mm-hmm. for the experience of the beauty and the power that's singular.
At the same time, I also don't want to say it doesn't matter. That is, an intelligent reading of Merchant of Venice or intelligent production of it will make you think about that problematic quality. Not even necessarily so much about Shakespeare himself, for whom, as you say, it's really hard to know ever what he thinks, which is part of his genius of the way he works. But the production, and there's a recent, a great film version of Merchant of Venice, where you really see a very nuanced, troubled sense of Shylock as a real human being caught in this world. So, I mean, I do think that even so, we need to read critically, and that's one of the purposes of any kind of critical introduction, including even Around the World in 80 Books in 1600 words. I'm trying to say, right, here's what's to look at in this writer. Here's what's so compelling, what's so good. Here may be the things not so much. So if you're reading, I don't know, Goethe's Faust, which has so much poetry, so much music, actual songs, so much going on that's so brilliant. At the same time, his representation of the eternal feminine, you know, maybe not.
Having you read something to us, if you don't mind. Could you
Yes.
Could you pick a little, either a poem or an excerpt or a paragraph from something that's on your mind lately, something that'll want to get us to go do some reading or at least go do some thinking?
Yeah, let me just give you a couple of examples from Aztec poetry from the 16th century. Here's a poem in which Cortes has brought some Aztec noblemen to meet the Pope in Rome. And one of them is a poet, and he writes this poem in Nahuatl that has survived for the folks back home. And he says, "Friends, willow men, behold the Pope, who's representing God, who speaks for him. The Pope is on God's mat and seat and speaks for him. Who is this reclining in a golden chair? Look, it's the Pope. He has his turquoise blowgun, and he's shooting in the world. It seems it's true. He has his cross and golden staff, and these are shining in the world. I grieve in Rome and see him in the flesh, and he's San Pablo. It seems that from the four directions they've been captured, you've made them enter into the golden refuge, and it's shining. It seems the Pope's home lies painted in golden butterflies. It's beaming." I think this is just a wonderful sense of this poet is trying to make the sense of a world so far from anything he knew and trying to make sense of it for the audience back home. And then he's translating it, right? So the Pope, Clement V, VII, was probably not sitting on a mat with a turquoise blowgun, but this was a way that the poet could convey the power and the strangeness of being in Rome to the audience back home. Just one last line from another poem. So has it been said by Tochi Huitzin, so has it been said by Koyo Chiuki. We come here only to sleep. We come here only to dream. It is not true. It is not true that we come to live on earth. Have we arrived? Have we sprung up on earth in vain? Shall I perish like flowers? Will my fame eventually fade away? Will my renown be nothing on earth? At least flowers, at least songs.
David Damrosch, reading for us excerpts that will, I think, be illuminating, as your book is that I'm holding here, Around the World in 80 Books, A Literary Journey. David Damrosch, indeed, I thank you.
Daniel, thank you.
You've been listening to Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk. The original theme music is by Ronald Barkham. The content coordinator is Nathaniel Mosse, and Doug Christian is executive producer. We invite you to subscribe and leave a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. You can support us at patreon.com/talkingbeats. That's patreon.com/talkingbeats. And be sure to check us out on social media. We'll see you next time on Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk.